Welcome to the Women in Public Policy Program Seminar Series podcast at the Harvard Kennedy School.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I know this is a super busy time of the semester, so I really appreciate you being here. I think we're in for a treat. We have Corinne here, Corinne Allo, who is going to talk to us today about betting the house, how assets influence marriage selection, marital stability, and child investments. But Corinne has already a really interesting career in running experiments, both in the lab and in the field, evaluating interventions and how they affect people. And one of my favorite papers is a paper that she has written jointly with Kathleen McGinn and Nava Asha, evaluating the impact of negotiation, which we don't do enough of. Although many of us teach negotiation, we don't typically evaluate the real impact that it has on people's lives. But even more so, they evaluated really important lives, namely Zambian girls' lives, and their ability to negotiate with their parents, with their teachers, kind of their freedom, their opportunities in many ways. So thank you for you doing that great work. Corinne joins us from the Wharton School, where she's an assistant professor. She has a PhD from Columbia. And has been a friend of the Women in Public Policy Program for a long time. So we're delighted to have you back. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I also want to welcome our podcast community. Sorry, I almost forgot that. Many, many people from around the world. So thank you very much for making this available to them.
Thank you so much. So I am an economist, as Iris mentioned, so please jump on in with questions. I will try to save some time at the end, but then we're used to the style of just everybody jumping in. So when you have a question, no need to hold it to the end. We'll discuss as we go along. And I didn't realize I was going to get such a thorough introduction, so I was going to start by telling you a little bit about my other work, but I will tell you just a little bit generally about the topics that I work on to give you sort of the framing for how we're going to approach the topic I'm going to discuss today. Because I work on women, the idea of women as economic agents. So I study women's decisions, but instead of looking at it as, oh, women are really different, and you know, maybe they have different preferences, or they have different abilities, or there's all these, you know, wishy-washy reasons why sometimes we see things like the gender wage gap, or we see different levels of human capital investments, or different outcomes, I try to just say, what if we just assume that women are people, and we can use the same economics tools that we use to study other people, right? Other agents. We can just assume that they're optimizing their own utility. That's, you know, the framework that economists use, subject to constraints. And so then the question is, you know, what are those constraints that are out there, and are any of them different maybe than the constraints faced by men? And so that you might get a different solution to that optimization problem, but the agent isn't any different who's doing it. It's just, you know, kind of facing a different problem, right? So a major area that I sort of have applied that framework is that I study how time-limited fertility, meaning the fact that, you know, women become less fecund, less able to have children earlier than men, how that impacts women's decision-making. So I call this reproductive capital because I want people to think about it as something of real economic value. I don't want us to think about it as like, oh, you know, women and their kids, right? I want us to say, look, women are holding a depreciating asset that brings a tremendous amount of value to the economy. And if any agent were holding this depreciating asset and they had to make a trade-off where they could invest in this other asset, which is human capital, but it's gonna take time and it's gonna let the reproductive capital depreciate more, right? Then of course there's a trade-off to be made. And of course this is something that has real financial and welfare implications for women. So I have a paper on this where I kind of prove that this is true, and I actually show that there's financial value of reproductive capital on the marriage market, and then I do an experiment where I actually randomly assign women's ages to dating profiles, and I show that the level of reproductive capital directly affects their outcomes on the marriage market. And then I also have work where I sort of then apply this to a policy setting where I say, what happens if we extend women's reproductive time horizons? Are they going to adjust the optimization and invest in more human capital? And we look at that via Israel, where they made in vitro fertilization completely free and government funded in 1994. So we went from sort of very little use of this new technology to a lot of use, a lot of knowledge. And we see that indeed, women get more education and, you know, invest more in their careers, et cetera, as you would expect. As Ira said, I also work on gender effects in negotiation, not just in Zambia, but also in the US. So I have work looking at, you know, do women and men negotiate differently? And maybe more importantly, do people negotiate differently against them? So if you know you are negotiating against a person of the other gender, and because we have people negotiating in computers, we can manipulate whether that's true or not, do you change your negotiating style? And we find that, in fact, people do, sometimes in surprising ways. And then a piece of research that you may have heard of about this is that we actually found that after the 2016 presidential election, that people drastically changed their approach, their negotiating approaches against women, and we see like 120% increase in aggressiveness against women in our lab study after the presidential election. And so then what I'm gonna, this brings me to my third kind of area of research of what I'm gonna talk about today, which is that I study what is the marriage contract from an economic standpoint. So just the way, the same way value is created and divided and exchanged on the labor market, value is created and exchanged and divided on the marriage market, right? And I want to understand, you know, what is valuable about that contract? Who reaps that value? And as policies change, how has the value of that contract changed over time? So what is the, like, you know, you can look at marriage sort of from one perspective as it has all this, these social things that go with it, right? It's about love and it's about family and whatever, but it also has an economic component to it. It is about actually this contract for investing in children, in the next generation's human capital, and this is something that by and large almost all people do. So economists love to study what things people consume, that you go to the grocery store and you buy groceries, or you're gonna go to the car dealership and buy a car, but people consume children at extremely high rates. Everybody loves to spend money on children, right? I like saying that. And when you're, that's clearly showing, signaling that that's something of economic value, right? That we all say, like, just the same way that we'd be like, oh, cars contribute this much to the GDP, right? That children are something of economic value. And a lot of the investments in those children are coming from women, right? And that's something that you, this may not surprise you to find out, is not costless, right? And so I want to understand, what purpose does the marriage contract serve in enabling those investments? And as that contract has changed over time, what are the implications of that? And that's what I'm going to talk about today. So marriage used to be something that was, if not universally done, universally aspired to, right? If anybody said, hey, I'm going to think about starting a family, the way you were going to do that was through marriage. I'm going to get married, I'm going to have kids, and that's kind of the goal. And it might not have been attainable for everybody, but it was sort of, that was the plan, right? And if you look around the world now, it's clear that that's no longer the case. Something has changed in that now marriage is sort of seen as just one of several options for how you might kind of progress through your life and potentially start a family. So we're seeing, you know, a rise in just cohabitation, maybe without children. We're also seeing a big rise in non-marital fertility. And it, I don't think that this is just because necessarily people's tastes have changed or social values have changed. I'm an economist, so I look at it as, you know, what in the equation has changed that's making people come to a different optimization decision. And importantly, when we look in the United States context, this isn't something that has just been applied equally throughout society. So it's not as though we're just all at once, everybody is kind of changing their mind about whether marriage is desirable. There's a tremendous amount of stratification in rates of marriage by income, education, and race, okay? So my question is, what made marriage valuable in the first place? And what has caused it to clearly retain some value for a segment of the population while losing it for other segments of the population? And you might be like, okay, well, why is that mysterious? Obviously, if people want to get married, it's a nice thing, you throw a big wedding, right? Well, let's look deeper than that. What are people really trying to do when they get married? So, you know, you might say it's a lot cheaper to live with somebody else than to kind of live on your own, okay? But you can capture those economies of scale through cohabitation, right? You can live with, you know, your boyfriend or your girlfriend, or you could just get a roommate, right? So it's possible to attain that without marriage. And you know, the problem with using marriage as the only way to attain that is that you're going to face some costs in the case the relationship goes south, right? You're going to have to disentangle yourself from this legal contract. Moreover, as we've brought in more enforcement of sort of paternity, both rights and responsibilities outside of marriage, the contract that's available for cohabitation has become more similar to the marriage contract. So it used to be that the only way that a father could actually have rights over their child, but moreover, responsibilities to care for their child, was actually through the marriage contract. And I'm gonna get a little bit more into that history, okay? But today, that's not the case anymore. So if you want to sort of have rights to see a child and also for the mother to have those responsibilities to know that the father is going to have to care for the child, you can do that through contracting that doesn't have to be through the marriage contract. So the key unexplored fact that we're going to look at today is that while these contracts have converged, the marriage contract and the contract available for cohabitation, and when I say converged, it's in two ways. It's that the security of the marriage contract has decreased while the security of the cohabitation contract has increased. The security of the marriage contract has decreased because divorce is much easier, and now legally in the United States, it can be unilateral. And we'll talk more about that later, but it used to be that both people had to agree to get divorced, and that's no longer the case. And as I said, the security of that cohabitation contract has gotten closer to the marriage contract. So as they've converged, there's one area in which they are completely, entirely different. And for people not from the US, I understand this is somewhat unique to the US context, which is that only in the marriage contract are assets divided upon divorce. Meaning that if you live in a home together and one partner is sort of making all of the mortgage payments, right, and accumulating this home equity, if you're not married and the relationship splits up, if you know he was paying all of the mortgage payments, she has no rights over the home. But if you're married, that house is either going to be divided or actually very frequently assigned to the mother, because they kind of look at it as, look, the children have been living in this home and they should kind of be able to continue living in this home, okay? So that's a key difference between the marriage contract and the non-marital contract. And you know, I understand in some other countries, if you cohabitate for long enough, you might have rights over that property. In the US, without the marriage contract, zero rights over property, right? And I say that that's the key difference because that's not the case for income. If you live with somebody for long enough, you have children with somebody, right, then he is going to be required to pay child support and therefore share his income if the relationship splits up. But asset sharing is unique to the marriage contract. So we propose a model where, given that, purchasing a home is the key way that husbands can sort of commit to their wives, right, that she's going to be okay in case the relationship fails. And what this creates is it creates an environment where it's safe for her, in terms of economically safe, to invest in the human capital of her children, even if it reduces her own income, because she's guaranteed that if the relationship fails, she's going to get something of value after the fact. And moreover, given that the house, this asset, is at risk, okay, it's actually going to discourage this unilateral divorce action of kind of him choosing to get divorced. So she's insured in two ways: lower probability of divorce, and that she's sort of going to have something to fall back on in case the relationship fails. So that's why we call this betting the house, because the idea is he's anteing up the house to secure the marriage contract. So I explained this to a layperson, and they said, are you saying marriage is a mortgage-backed security? Oh yeah, I'm saying child human capital is a mortgage-backed security. That she's willing to invest in child human capital because it's secured via this home equity that she gets to share in case it doesn't pan out the sort of traditional way of staying together and sharing the expenses of that investment. Okay, sorry, you had a question.
You're going to focus on the U.S. I was wondering if there is also a question of fiscality, because in some countries, taxation, if you are married or not married, matters a lot. I know for France, but it's for other countries. I don't know about the U.S., so is that a concern? Or?
Yes, so there are tax benefits to being married and filing jointly, and so you're right that that is an additional place where the marriage contract sort of diverges from the non-marital contract. Importantly, that hasn't changed over time, okay. So that sort of it has stayed stable, but you're right that that's something we should at least sort of bring in there as an additional
difference between those two. So it's sort of well known that children from married parents appear to get higher levels of investment than children from unmarried parents, okay? And I think there's some question in there about whether that is selection, meaning it's the people who are, you know, choosing to get married, who kind of have the resources to get married and live this kind of traditional life, right? Who are choosing to also invest heavily in their children, or whether there's actually something about the marriage contract that enables this investment, okay? And we're gonna argue that it's both. In the model that I'm gonna show you, you're gonna see that both higher income people are going to sort of choose to get married and choose to invest more in children, but also that being married by providing this security enables a higher level of investment. So investing in child quality has a cost. And the way we're gonna model it is that it takes up somebody's time, right? Somebody is going to have to do it. And if you spend that time, time is limited. And if you spend that time investing in your child's human capital, you're less able to spend that time investing in your own human capital, right? Which means that women's wages are going to be, and let me just quickly explain why I keep saying women. The reason is that just if you look at the data, the people who are making these large time investments in children tend to be women. And when you see how children affect wages, you see that men don't experience a decline in wages from having children. And there's now multiple papers showing that women do. That if you look at the gender wage gap, actually a large part of it sort of only kicks in once you actually have people start having children, because that's when it becomes difficult to make these high levels of human capital investments. So in our model, we build that in by having women have a slightly lower income distribution than men, and then it makes sense to have the slightly lower income partner invest in children. Another way you could think about it is that biologically, there are certain parts of the childbearing process that tend to be done by women, right? So that's pregnancy, birth, and breastfeeding, right? And then you can imagine there's complementarities where if you did that part, then it makes sense for you to make these other investments too. And so there's just a piece of the investment that really can't be shared, and that's why I'm gonna keep sort of giving this gendered language to the setup here. Okay, so marriage previously provided some safety or some guarantee that those investments were gonna be rewarded because you were committed to just share a household and share income over the long term, right? But suddenly marriage became more precarious because divorce got really easy and really common. And what that meant is that you can imagine being a woman who has very high skill and could be an extremely high-earning person if she invested heavily in her own human capital, but she takes 10 years off to invest in her children's human capital, whether that's not working or working part-time, right? And then imagine at the end of those 10 years, she gets divorced, okay? So suddenly the terms under which she's invested have changed, right? So instead of saying, I'm investing, but my husband's earning this, investing in his own human capital, and he's earning this high income, and we're gonna share that income, suddenly I'm left with my own lowered income and some kind of a transfer coming in from him, right? So you could make this investment and then sort of be left with the entire cost of this investment. So that means that this insurance of the marriage contract lessens and it disappears, right? So high asset individuals, on the other hand, are still able to offer some of this insurance because there's this marital home or there's other financial assets that are going to be divided. And so if the marriage breaks up and that term of the contract that you had in mind of, you know, hey, for the next 40 years we're gonna be sharing income, if that suddenly goes poof, you're gonna be left at least with this share of the assets. And so you're not gonna be just left with only this lowered income because of the lower human capital investments. So there's a really interesting paper by Shelley Lundberg and Bob Pollack that has looked at why is there so much stratification in marriage, and they speculated that it's that marriage today is only useful for people who really want to invest in the human capital of children. And they say this tends to be really high income people, and that's why we see high income people and high education people continue to get married, whereas lower income and lower education people don't. The key difference with our paper is that we're going to argue this has nothing to do with the desire to invest in your children, but rather with the ability to secure that investment through these assets that can be anteed up and actually secure the contract. So we're not gonna say that it's based on different tastes for investing in your children, but rather that there's this underlying difference in the availability of the contract when you have assets versus when you don't have assets. Yes?
So
In terms of the increase in rates of divorce, it seems like the sketch of a model there sort of is life ends after first divorce. I imagine over time that it's also becoming more common that people in these high-income couples that do get divorced, that the woman with children is able to remarry. And so divorce has become more common, but maybe not necessarily more risky, although it's an empirical question, because I can actually go and marry someone new.
Right. So the key fact that makes that makes there still be a tremendous amount of risk for women is related to my other work on reproductive capital, that if she spends her 15 years, you know, within this one marriage, she's actually, because of lowered reproductive capital, much less appealing on the remarriage market than he is. And so that's borne out in the data that women have much lower remarriage rates than men do. So that's not saying it doesn't happen, but it's saying in terms of getting the same type of marriage that's going to be economically advantageous and having a higher income spouse who's going to be able to, you know, provide some economic transfers this direction, that's much less likely to happen after the first marriage.
Has that been changing over time?
Rates of remarriage have increased a lot, but this, like, that older women are disadvantaged on the marriage market hasn't changed very much. So that's still, there's still going to be a penalty associated with that. Yes?
Just a clarification question. Remind me, so when in cohabitation, so assets aren't shared. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. So if you, no matter how long you live with somebody, if he's paying the mortgage, it's his house. But the difference is when you're married, because there's some understanding in the legal system that the implicit contract is he's paying the marriage, but you're providing other services. Yep. So this is a really joint property that's being acquired. It doesn't matter that he's writing the checks. It's joint property. And so if you get divorced, it's divided.
But there's zero. I would just try to understand clarification.
Zero sharing.
And you would say in other countries, I mean, again, there's like a million things are different. But
yes.
On the other hand, this might be one of the things you would look out for and say, maybe that would explain different patterns.
Exactly, and I'm gonna talk about that. This is just a US paper, but at the end I'll talk about the implications for some other countries, because there's also the idea that in other countries, a bigger social insurance, like a bigger public sector, might substitute a little bit for some of this private insurance through the marriage contract. Yes?
Maybe you wanna defer this question until later, or maybe you can just not answer it altogether, but I'm sitting here, ruminating about how your work will fit in with in like slightly adjacent fields like psychology, so work by like Eli Finkel on marriage and work on like sexual economics by Kathleen Voss and Roy Baumeister. Are you familiar with this stuff?
Not really. I have to. This is like where economists are terrible, is that we tend to be very. I think I know about a lot of the work on sociology that sort of studies this change in the marriage contract over time, but not the stuff in psychology. So it's something I'd be glad to talk more about afterwards, because I would love to hear sort of what the similarities and the differences are. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the work on remarriage and what the numbers are, but I wondered if, though certainly, yes, we see that women are going to be less marketable in a second marriage when they're post-reproduction. But do we also see a difference in taste as women have more economic ability to support themselves to not choose second marriage, where we see a very consistent pattern that men, since they have gains of health, economics, and other things which are really consistent with marriage that women don't?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people have suggested that, you know, maybe the difference on the remarriage market is that men need wives, but women don't need husbands, right? and I think that there's definitely something to that, but I just think, I think it's also true that there's a very consistent, empirically documented pattern that women are economically worse off after divorce, and that easier divorce has made women economically worse off on average. So
right,
it's true that there's an economic loss that's happening there. Yeah.
I don't know if this is relevant to your time frame, but I'm wondering how you would reconcile this with the introduction of reproductive technologies that makes now, if you want to invest in a child, it's really because you wanted the child. Well, before, marriage was some kind of protection because you didn't really choose when you were having a child. So I'm wondering how you can reconcile this with the introduction of the pill and abortion technology.
Yes, that's very, very interesting. And I think there has definitely been related work on how the introduction of that technology also led to more non-marital childbearing, because there were some sort of different contracting problems and moral hazard that it introduced, where now you have an option to prevent pregnancy. So if you don't, there might be less of an obligation to get married if it does happen and stuff like that. So I think it's true that that's sort of something that's going on in the background. It's going to be a little bit earlier than some of the changes that I'm going to be talking about. And I think the important thing is I'm going to be able to show you empirically that whatever changed the sort of rates of marriage over time, there's just this huge interaction with assets, where for people with assets, those rates just haven't changed in the same way. And that's when I'm going to go through a model first, and then I'm going to show you the sort of changes over time. So let me just show you just sort of the suggestive empirical evidence that says, like, hey, maybe we're onto something here, which is that, as I said, there's this big stratification in marriage rates by income, by race, by education. So what we did is we controlled for all of those things, and I show you that assets are still a really significant determinant. No, that doesn't
matter. It's not.
Okay. And that assets are still a really significant determinant of whether people get married. So this is, you know, conditioning on all of those factors. So looking like within racial groups, whether or not you have assets matters, right? Within an income bracket, the people with assets are going to marry more, the people without assets are going to marry less. So that's the first piece of suggestive evidence. And then the key asset I'm going to be looking at is I'm going to be looking at the marital home. And the reason we sort of just call it the home in the model, just to simplify things, is that that's really like a key asset that people invest in the US. So that's something that's not everybody owns assets, but the people who do own assets, almost all of them own property, right? And there's some questions about why, because it's a really illiquid asset, it's inconvenient in a lot of ways, it's volatile, right? But you know, this model is sort of gonna give you a reason why actually a home is an appealing asset, and its illiquidity might actually be a benefit, because it means it's sort of, hey, it's there and it's standing there as I said, this ante, right? It's like tying the house to the mast to say, like, yes, I'm guaranteeing that there's gonna be something of value there. And the other thing about homes that are really nice is that it allows us to sort of say, like, look, it doesn't even matter if the assets were premarital or postmarital, because divorce only specifies that assets acquired post-marriage are divided. But if you have assets because you have an inheritance when you come into marriage, it's going to allow you to place a down payment on a house, which is going to mean that every subsequent mortgage payment is accumulated in this joint asset that's going to be divided upon divorce. So that's why even when we look at just the link of did you come into the marriage with assets, it's going to make marriage a lot more common, because you're able to then buy the house and the house becomes joint marital property. So it's sort of a way of like converting this money that isn't necessarily tied down to this asset that is going to be tied down. And it's a crucial asset to the American middle class, representing 66% of all wealth in the American middle class. Okay, so
Lauren, just because you just mentioned that now, made me think, does it depend on what kind of asset you have? Because the other advantage of the house is it's hard to hide.
Oh, that's absolutely right. So it's also like, and I think that again, if you don't have this model in mind, it seems like it makes it unappealing. Why would you invest in something that is gonna be illiquid, is gonna be hard to hide upon divorce, and you know you're gonna have to share? And in our model, the idea is that ex ante, which is the economist term for like before they enter the contract, right? Men like the idea that they're tied down in this contract. Why? Because they want a marriage where their wife is going to be willing to make these investments in children that are jointly optimal for the couple. So they prefer all of these things that make it sort of seem unappealing. They prefer those features of this asset because it's what allows them to enter into this really beneficial contract. So this is just another piece of suggestive evidence before I get into the model, which is that I kind of, in this longitudinal data set called the SIP, I look at people who don't get married and people who do get married, and I kind of stack all the people who do get married so that their marriages occur at time zero. And what you see is that right at time zero, the people who get married just start acquiring homes at like a really fast pace, whereas the people who don't get married, whether they're cohabitated, whether they have roommates, whatever it is, they have no use for them, right? A piece of this is selection. That's why you start out with a gap between these two groups, that the people who get married are positively selected, but marriage is really tied to this home acquisition, and this model is going to explain why. So now that you sort of have that suggestive evidence, let me get into the model and what the mechanisms are. So apologies for anybody who doesn't like to hear about their research in math terms. This is going to be the mathy section, and then we'll sort of get back into some other stuff. But I'll try to give you the intuition for what's driving the model. So we set up this model of marriage where individuals live for two periods and they have an endowment, which you can think of as their skill or their ability to earn income, okay? And we're gonna just make this assumption to keep things easy and have the woman be the one to invest, that the distribution of male endowments is slightly larger than the distribution of female endowments. that's true in any setting where you have a little, just a little bit of wage discrimination or something like that, right? So the man has a slightly higher ability to earn than the woman on average. And men are also going to have this endowment of assets where they can either have enough assets to buy a house or they don't have assets. So they vary in two dimensions, income and assets. Individuals are going to decide in the first period whether they want to be single, in which case you can't have kids, cohabitate and have kids, so that's non-marital fertility, or get married and have kids. Single individuals just eat their own income and assets. If you're in a relationship, whether it's non-marital fertility or whether it's marriage, you're going to have a child, and so you can choose what portion of kind of your endowment you want to put into your child. So the way that works is that we're going to have a time budget, and you can either put your time budget into your child's human capital or into your own human capital. If you put it into your child's human capital, your earnings are going to be reduced in the second period. And the people who are in this relationship, both the husband and the wife, benefit from child quality, so they like any kind of investments in children that make the children better, and they like them more. And when they're together, when that relationship lasts, they're committed to share resources. So resources are shared by sort of assumption when the relationship lasts. Yes, Heather?
So can you tell me why women wouldn't have any endowment of assets before they come into the relationship, and what it might do to your model if they did?
Yes, so we kind of played around with that, and we decided like it just didn't add anything. So as long as if you have women have assets, because they sort of don't have the same incentive to secure the marriage contract in this way, it sort of doesn't matter. So as long as the men's assets become important because the woman is making the time investment in children, right? So the woman's assets, they would provide her some additional security in case the marriage breaks up. But as long as you have some women who don't have assets too, then the model is going to hold true for them. So it's sort of like didn't really add anything to the model, and that's why we just kind of simplified it. But it's not that we're saying that that's true. It's just saying that it's only men's assets that actually play the role that we're talking about.
And it's not a necessary condition for the model that women don't have assets.
Exactly. Right. It's just that basically the model would most apply to the women without their own assets, because the women with assets might care less about insurance through marriage because they kind of have access to their own resources.
Thank you.
Yes?
In the empirics you showed us to motivate that, can you look at Kathleen's question? Like you showed us that assets are predictive of marriage. Was that only for men?
That was for men. And we found that women's assets were a lot less predictive of marriage, but that's something, yeah, that's a good idea.
But not a negative sign.
Okay, so, and I think that would also be something that you would have to look at, because there's also like a lot of positive assortative matching, so the slight positive might be because they're selecting men who also have higher assets, right? So, okay, so now, so a little bit more math in terms of what does the utility function look like. So, if you're a woman who's single, you're just going to eat your endowment. And if you're a man who's single, in the first period you have your endowment, and in the second period there's nothing left to do with your asset, so you eat your asset as well. So whatever's inside the utility function is your consumption level. If you're in a relationship, then this is a woman in a relationship. In the first period, you have your utility from consumption, and you also have your utility from child quality, which depends on the time investment that you put into the child. And the reason there's a two here is because you're going to enjoy this in both periods, okay? So first period, consumption and child quality. Second period, child quality and consumption, but it has this tilde on it because your second period consumption is uncertain. And the reason it's uncertain is because you don't know if the relationship is going to stay together or if it's going to split up. And if it stays together, you're going to continue sharing resources with your husband. And if it splits up, you're just going to have your own resources plus whatever the sort of breakup settlement is. Okay? And that breakup settlement is going to depend on whether you're coming from a cohabitating relationship or whether you're coming from a marriage relationship. And then we're just going to have a fixed cost of entering into the relationship that we're going to call R. So women are going to make the child investment decision, which is how much of their tau do they want to put into the child. And putting in tau to the child obviously increases the child's quality. So this DQ, D tau, how the quality changes in tau, this is going to be positive. But it decreases her expected second period utility. Okay, and the reason it does that is because it decreases her own income. So if she's in a relationship, because resources are going to be shared, then that's going to be shared. That decrease in income is going to be a hit for both people in the relationship, right? It's, yeah, she's not earning as much, but we pool our income and then we put it into a joint pot and then we divide it back out again, right? So you're sharing it. But if she's not in the relationship, then she's gonna own more of that cost of the investment that she made. She's gonna be facing this lower second period earning, and you can think about it as just like basically take her omega I and multiply it by one minus tau. She only gets however much of it she didn't put into children, right? So she's gonna get this lower earning, and then she might get some kind of an income transfer, but it's not gonna make up for that, right? We know that sort of, as I said, women are economically worse off after divorce, so whatever the child support settlement is, it's not enough to make up for this investment that she made. And then she could potentially get a share of the asset if one exists, and if she were married. If she's not married, then she's not gonna get a share of the assets. So we assume that if they stay together, we could say, look, they share resources equally. We could also say that maybe the marriage isn't equal. Maybe she gets beta less than one half of the resources. This is still gonna work. This is still gonna go through because the point is, no matter what share of that joint pot she gets out, she's still getting part of her income and part of his income. Whereas after divorce, she's taking her income home, right? Okay, so you can think of child quality as a public good, where basically, public used loosely words, the family, right? Where basically he benefits from it and she benefits from it, but she's bearing a disproportionate share of the cost. The private costs are higher than the shared costs, right? Because she's paying for it in a shared way only if they stay married, and if they break up, she's paying for almost that entire cost, okay? So what do you know about public goods? You know that in general, without some kind of intervention, they're gonna be underprovided, right? So she's gonna be like, oh, maybe I don't wanna stay home for 8 years. Maybe I just wanna stay home for 3 years because I've gotta really look out for my own career because he's not sharing the cost of this investment fully with me, okay? So that's a key sort of thing to understand as we get into the next step of the model, is that in either marriage or non-marital fertility, the investment in children's quality is gonna be lower than what would be socially optimal if you had kind of perfect contracting, perfect insurance, okay? So you can just think of it as like there's exactly equal benefits for husband and wife, but not exactly shared costs, and that means that it's a public goods problem and she's gonna underprovide it. And that problem's gonna be more intense in sort of non-marital fertility because the contracting is gonna be a little worse there. So then what do assets do, and why is marriage gonna be really different from non-marital fertility if there are assets? Okay, so going back to this equation, this is how she chooses the optimal tau. This is the first order condition. And it's that I need the marginal benefit to me, because I only care about my own experience of child quality, right? I need the marginal benefit to be equal to the marginal cost, okay? So the marginal benefit is how does my tau change child quality? The marginal cost, and the one half comes from the fact that she enjoys this in two periods. The marginal cost is the fact that it's reducing my second period consumption, right? So anything that makes this kind of more negative means I'm gonna put less tau into the child quality because it's raising the marginal cost. Similarly, anything that reduces this effect, that my tau decreases my expected second period utility, is going to mean I'm gonna be willing to put more tau into child quality, okay? So that's the role of assets. Assets are gonna reduce the negative impact of investment on expected second period utility. And it's gonna do this through two channels. The first channel is that it's going to give her something to eat because she's gonna get a share of assets in the divorced state, okay? And when utility is concave, I'm gonna say it the math way, then I'll say it the plain English way. So when utility is concave, having that extra something in the utility function means I care less about the negative effect of investment on my own income, right? Because I already have something, so I'm at sort of this flatter part of the curve, so I don't care as much about the fact that, hey, my investment reduced my own income. So the plain English way of saying that is that she sort of is guaranteed a minimum level of consumption, right? So she doesn't have to think as much about, oh, am I making, $50 from my job, or am I making $35 about my job? Because she's kind of sitting on a lump sum that says, look, I already have $100 a week that, is just there, right? Okay. So that's the first way, is that when we call that the consumption insurance channel, because she's guaranteed a certain baseline level of consumption in the divorced state, she's not going to worry as much about this negative impact of investment on her own income. The second way that it reduces the effect of investment on second period consumption, second period utility, is that it actually discourages the husband from divorcing, because he knows he has to share the asset if he gets divorced. He's gonna think twice, and we're gonna be looking at a world where divorce decisions are unilateral, so you know he's gonna get what economists call a love shock, right? Where he says, hey, actually, I wanna get out of this relationship, but then he's gonna think, oh, but I'm gonna have to split up the house, so maybe, you know, I can make it work. Maybe I prefer to make it work. Yes, Kevin?
The really interesting fun part about this is we know about the fatherhood bonus, right? So,
so you
could easily put the fatherhood bonus into this model. So his income is going
yes.
up with parenting, and now her incentive, this is really horribly sexist as I say it, but I'm just like, these are the genders you've given them. Her incentive is to make sure that all or even more than that bonus goes toward the house.
Yeah.
So as his income goes up,
yeah.
we want to get a bigger,
yes.
bigger house.
Yes. And you can imagine what's interesting about this is that he might want that too, because he
yeah.
says, oh, like, the more my income goes up and yours goes down, because we have the Tao in there as being about whether she invests in her own career. If you think about it instead as someone's got to put in the Tao, when she puts it in, she's investing in his career. So she's like giving him the fatherhood bonus, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so as that happens, the more that they diverge, the more she's going to think like, you know what, I better stop doing this because I'm putting myself in a really risky position. So he might want to get that bigger house too, because
right.
it's going to mean that she's going to keep agreeing to those terms rather than saying like, this isn't working for me, I'm going back to work and you need to be the one to stay home, right? So again, just that second channel is that it reduces the probability of divorce, which is going to shift weight towards that married scenario where they share the costs more equally and away from the scenario where they don't. So therefore, we assume that there's super modularity between assets and investment, which is that the marginal cost of investing is lower when you are married and there's sufficient assets to buy a house. When you are unmarried, if you're in non-marital fertility, whether or not there's assets for a house doesn't affect your cost of investing because it's not going to be divided, okay? So the terms of whether or not you're going to invest or not are going to be very different, whether you have assets or not, for married couples, which means, this is the first proposition, that couples who have sufficient assets to buy a house are going to more easily harvest the benefits of marriage, because remember, child investment was too low. So if we can get child investment higher because you have this house and it decreases the cost of investment, marriage is going to be more valuable. So we're going to be more willing to pay whatever that cost is of entering into marriage. So the higher the level of assets are, the more those couples are going to get married. So that's the first big result, is that marriage is going to be more common for people with assets than without. And that's going to be strengthened whenever you have something that makes the marriage contract worse or makes the alternate contract better. It's going to strengthen this difference between people with assets and people without. And so that's our second set of propositions, that if we make two policy changes that really happened in the U.S. over the past 40 years, one, switch from bilateral divorce to unilateral divorce, which means when there was bilateral divorce, I'll take Mad Men as, you know, absolutely historical fact, okay? There was this scene where Roger Sterling wants to get divorced, and Jane says, okay, but it's going to cost you. Because there was bilateral consent to divorce, you basically had to cut a check to get her to sign the paper to say, yes, I'm gonna get divorced. Once that's not required by the court anymore, once, you know, as long as he wants to get divorced, fine, they're going to grant the divorce, she's not guaranteed to that transfer at the time of divorce, right? So she loses that piece of insurance, which was that she used to have to agree to get divorced. So that means this insurance for the asset is going to become all the more important. So that's the proposition, that when we move from bilateral divorce to unilateral divorce, it's going to decrease marriage for people without assets. But depending on the parameters, it could create either very little change or even no change for people with assets, because people with assets are still able to secure their marriages. They have this insurance through the asset division. And the second one is the second real policy change that happened is that it used to be the only way to get parental rights and also have this guarantee of child support was through the marriage contract. What if we introduce this alternate contract where he's required to pay for the child even though you're not married, right? Well, now all of a sudden, the non-marital contract is just as good as the marriage contract for people without assets, right? It's only if you have assets that you get extra security by getting married. So the people without assets are gonna really switch away to this newly available non-marital contract. Whereas the people with assets, why would they consider doing this? Because the married contract is still a lot better for them because they get much more investment through the fact that they are committing to divide the assets. And so that's gonna map onto the real historical change that we've seen, which is that people without assets have fled marriage, whereas people with assets have continued to get married. Yes?
And just a quick question. I would be really curious to hear how you think this relates to kind of the sunk cost fallacy. So like, because one way I could think about this is, I've already done so and so much with this person, and so now let's do more, or like buy a house, or, you know.
So, I think, I mean, you don't need sunk cost fallacy for anything to go through here. So like you don't need, like you could say like, oh, is this only true because people are irrational and they buy the house because they're happy and they're in love, and then they're like, oh shoot, respect with the house, I'm stuck in this marriage or whatever it is. But that's kind of the nice thing here is that the husband wants to get into this commitment. He wants to get into this commitment because he economically benefits from her investment in children. I think that's the key thing, is recognizing that what she provides in the marriage is of tremendous value, right? And so he wants to guarantee her this, you know, settlement, let's say, right? Because it means that she's actually gonna make this investment that's hugely valuable to him. So you kind of don't need to be irrational to get this to happen. Yeah. Sorry, back there.
Have you tested anything on like prenups as a factor?
You know what? What I think this exactly goes to my answer to this question, which is prenups are available. Why don't more people sign them? And why, when you see extremely wealthy people sign prenups, it's never like she gets nothing, right? I can guarantee you that Melania Trump's prenup does not say she gets nothing, right? It always guarantees her a certain amount of assets. So why are prenups, when they're available, so uncommon? And why do they always still guarantee a large settlement to the sort of person, the wife is entering into them? It's because, again, men value the availability of this contract that guarantees her a certain level of consumption so that she's willing to make these jointly optimal decisions of, you know, whatever it is, you know, reducing her own career investments and spending her both human capital and reproductive capital on this couple's children. Okay, one more question, then I should keep going. Anything apparent, then I'll come to.
So in the model, you have no social norm, and I'm wondering how you can. So Tao is a choice for women. There's no Tao for men, and how do you reconcile that with the fact that there's an increasing trend in the men spending time with their children mm-hmm. much more today than a couple of decades ago, especially high-skilled men, so whose time is more efficient than
yes.
others? Do you think it could somehow work in your model? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. So what? There's actually some kind of other related work on this, and I'm not gonna be like, I think that social norms indeed do change, right? I think that men do invest in children, right? But if I wanted to take the model really literally, I would say that that is actually going to be a result of the declining ability to enter into this optimal contract, is that the more fragile the contract is, the more she's going to say, look, we've got to share the investments because I'm not insured anymore against the breakup of this relationship. And so you're going to actually move to an equilibrium of more shared investments, and that's why marriage loses its value. And some people sort of say, oh, okay, I'm not going to enter into marriage at all, right? So, I don't think that's all that's going on, but it actually is certainly an implication of the model that you're going to have more contracts that look like that. Okay, so let's get into the empirical tests, and then I want to be able to spend some time talking about kind of the broad policy implications, because I don't know if you're already picking up on where some of this is going, but this actually has sort of enormous social policies and welfare implications in terms of when we look at who gets married and who doesn't. This now says, oh, this is about whether you can access this contract, and that's going to have tremendous effect on not just your life, but on the lives of the next generation, right? So I'm going to show you the empirics, and I want to make sure I leave some time for that discussion. So the first thing we do to test our model is that our model says that people who are able to secure their marriages through home, you know, do that mortgage-backed security, are going to be able to invest more in their children and have more specialization, division of labor within the household versus sort of shared investments, exactly as you said. And so we use idiosyncratic variation in housing prices at the time of marriage, meaning we look at how expensive were houses when you got married relative to all of the other years, houses today, prices in all of the other localities where you were not getting married and we're not looking to buy a house, right? And if you were just facing, for whatever reason, a housing boom, meaning prices were really high when you got married, you're going to be less able to purchase a house when you get got married, meaning your relationship is going to be less secure than somebody who happened to be facing sort of lower housing prices and was able to purchase a house. So we use the American Community Survey, where we can look at your marriage history, so we know what year and what location did this happen in, and then we merge that with the Federal Housing Finance Agency's HPI index of house prices, and then, like I said, we look at the housing price in the year that you got married, I keep trying to use that thing, as the sort of key thing, controlling for the housing prices in other years, including the current year. So the first thing I want to show you is that this actually has bite, meaning that if you were facing these high housing prices, you are less likely to own a home today. So the people who just had sort of the bad luck to get married in a year and a place where housing prices were really high, they were more likely to become renters. I mean, just think about it. When you were thinking, do I want to buy a house or do I want to be a renter? You're going to compare the two prices, right? If you're facing high housing prices, it's going to be harder to arrange the down payment. You're just less likely to get into that in the first place. But that persists to today. So this is looking at your history of when you got married. And the point is that today, you're less likely to be a homeowner just because of that housing price at the time that you got married. So then we look at whether that actually affects child investment, okay? And I don't want to push these results too strongly, because I'm going to tell you that there could be some other explanations for that, but then I'm going to tell you how we can try to rule that out, okay? So what we see is that the people who were facing these idiosyncratically high housing prices at the time that they got married, they have fewer children, and their children are more likely to be held back a grade, meaning this appears like they're getting maybe less human capital investments from the mother, and the mother's also making this choice of having fewer children. Why would she do that? Because obviously if you have three children instead of two, it means more time off of your job, right? Which means this higher cost to you later. Okay, why do I not want to push this too hard? Because you could say, is just having a house itself a treatment, meaning like you have a house and now you're like, it's easier for me to study with my children, or it's easier, it's bigger, so I can have more kids, so that's why I'm gonna have more kids, right? So there's a possibility that this is a direct effect of home ownership, or it comes through an income effect of home appreciation from that you actually bought a cheap house and now it's worth more. Yes?
Well, another reason you might not have a home and also your kids might not be doing as well is like if you're moving a lot.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. So the house could just sort of provide some direct benefits, right? And so this is consistent with our model, but what I really wanna find is I wanna find something that goes one direction for one set of people and a different direction for different people, so it can't be explained by those forces. And so to do that, I'm gonna look at the difference between men's and women's labor supply. Because any of those sort of direct stories, you would say, well, that would affect men and women the same. If it's easier when you own a home to leave your kids at home so you can go to the office, right, because you have a really safe environment for them, it would affect men and women's labor supply the same. If it's an income effect of the fact that you have this house that appreciated over time, it's gonna have the same impact on labor supply for men and women. So what we show is that this housing price index in the year that you got married has an entirely different impact on men versus women. So here I'm showing the difference in differences. So I'm showing the female effect relative to the male effect, which is that women relative to men are significantly more likely to have worked and to work more hours when they were kind of induced to not own a home. So this is that lower specialization, which is exactly what you were talking about, which is that because there's no home to secure her investments, she's putting in less investments in the form of actually spending that time at the office instead. And so, as I said, this is the D&D. If I showed it separately for women versus men, it's a positive sign for women, meaning fewer homes, more work, and a negative sign for men, meaning fewer homes, actually less work, because it's like might be an indicator of a bad economy or something like that. Yes?
So that's my question. So it's an indicator of the economy and where they live. So if I'm in a couple, mm-hmm.
where housing prices are really high, and especially if there's an employment issue with my partner, then I'm more likely to work because like life costs more and there's more indeterminacy, like I'm less secure about the other person's.
Yeah.
So this might have a lot to do with the fact that it just costs more to live in places where houses cost more.
So I should have, when I said that, even when you control for things, there's like kind of a residual left over. And I said, you know, there could be potentially residual variation in like factors like the economy, but really we're controlling for that because we're controlling for the current housing prices, right? We're controlling for how does the economy look today, right? What is causing the variation is how the housing market looked when you got married. So, you know, what it looks like today is in there. But I think the key thing is that, we can show this, is that, you know, there is some of that sometimes male industries decline while female industries don't, but in general, economic outcomes are correlated. So in general, we sort of see that like if it's a bad economy, it would be hard for both people to work, and you know, if it's a good economy, you'll see more by both people. And I think also the thing is, it's not just employment, it's usual hours worked, and they both go in opposite directions, meaning for men, it's not just like, oh, they're unemployed, it's that here we're showing that they work fewer hours while women work more hours, you know, and the intensive margin where they both actually have jobs.
Sorry, yes. I may have missed this. What's the time frame for your data set?
It's 2008 to 2014, but the marriage histories go back further than that. The marriage histories go back, I think, until like the earliest marriage we look at would be 1990 because we have to have children under 18. So.
But that being 2008 is a rather unique time. Housing prices is your
definitely concern. And so we did a robustness check of just trying to drop sort of the period, because remember it's not the data where the years come from, it's the years where they got married that sort of really matters, but we've tried dropping the marriages that took place during that variation during the housing crisis. I think that's a good point. And actually in future work we might try using that for identification to say, hey, there was a really big change and that was kind of unanticipated. I want to show you two more empirical results and then I'll come to you, Katie. Okay, so I'm going to skip this one because I want to get to the changes over time as we had policy changes. So remember I told you our model implies that when you make divorce unilateral, that's going to affect people with and without assets very differently. And when you introduce paternity establishment outside of marriage, again, that's going to have two different effects depending on whether you are an asset person or a no asset person. So we look at this in the PSID, which is another data set where we can actually look at a panel of people over time and we can look at whether or not they have assets. So the first one I'm going to look at is divorce laws, which changed in the 70s, and that's why I use the PSID because that has coverage during the 70s. So I'm going to look at whether you're in a state year that introduced unilateral divorce interacted with whether you have assets or not, controlling for the effect of assets, the effect of unilateral divorce, and you know, state fixed effects, time fixed effects, etc., right? And what you see is that unilateral divorce, and we don't have a lot of power in here, the PSID, once you restrict it in certain ways, is a pretty small sample, so it's only significant at the 10% level, but what you see is that sign-wise, unilateral divorce has a negative impact on marriage, right, because marriage is going to be less appealing the more it's this risky contract, but we interact that with assets, we see a positive coefficient that's going to cancel out that negative coefficient. So marriage rates are going to be unchanged for the people who have assets. And I'm now going to do the same exercise for the introduction. This shows that it's both whether they ever get married and how long it takes them to get married. I'm going to do the same exercise for the introduction of paternity establishment outside of marriage. The best variation in this comes because it was a kind of a national change that happened in the 90s with welfare reform, where people said, hey, we're going to start, and also the introduction of DNA testing, where people said, we're going to start establishing if you're the father or not, no matter whether you're married or not. But the best variation that was implemented at very different times is this in-hospital paternity establishment, where basically in the hospital they would be like, are you the father? Sign this. And that meant right then you were committing to sort of pay child support and you know, and then they could pursue you the same way they could if you had a marriage contract, right? So this in-hospital paternity establishment has been shown to actually decrease marriage, which was not the intention of the policy. The intention of the policy was to increase the involvement of fathers because the idea was, you know, you're signing up these fathers and you're getting them to commit, they're going to be more involved. But actually, because now people are going to move out of the marriage contract to choose this alternate contract, on average, you might not actually be increasing the involvement of fathers. So that's been shown by other work by a researcher named Maya Rawson Slater. What we're going to show is that that impact is completely different based on whether you have assets or not. So it's only for the people who don't have assets that we see that negative sign. And when we interact it with assets, we see that, you know, again, it's going to cancel out that negative effect, that having these laws, this alternate contract, it just isn't appealing to the people who have the ability to secure their contract through their assets. So Katie, let me come to your question. Is it relevant now? Sorry.
No, it's okay. I was trying to think about how childcare fits into all of this, and when we were talking more about state of the economy, in general, for people with assets or without assets, when the economy gets better, do married women with kids work more or less? So you can imagine.
Interesting.
I don't know which way it goes. It may be that the women who are working more when the economy is bad are actually women who want to be investing in the children, but
right,
can't.
But can't, yeah. No, that's a really good question. I should look at that because I don't know the answer.
It could go either
yeah.
way. I have no idea.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
That's a bit of a follow-up to Katie's question. Because you mentioned in passing before that demand for male and female jobs is pretty correlated. Is that true post-financial crisis?
So it's not true. You can definitely find places where they diverge, right, and time periods where they diverge, but it's true, like, sort of on average. So I think, again, this is something I should look at more closely. Right.
It turned out not to be true. So what happened?
Look, Kathleen knows.
So male employment dropped really, really steeply right afterwards because of construction and things like that. Female employment didn't. And so females picked up the slack for males early, and then male employment started back up again. So you actually have a period, and I don't know how long it lasted, but this is why I didn't know the years either. So 2008 to 2014, you have a period there of at least a few years where you have exactly what you're seeing, which is women are continuing to be employed and men are less employed. And as men's employment went down, women engaged.
Yeah, so I think that's, again, why it's important that this is true when we drop those years, because the bulk of the marriages that we're looking at are taking place in the 90s because we're doing this backwards looking approach from our data. But I think it could, for a different paper, it could be super interesting identification to look at that and to say, do you have differences in how important this contract is when you have different employment opportunities for men versus women? So what I want to show you before I get into the discussion, I have this in the wrong order, so I'm going to do this and I'm going to come back because this really relates to the what I just talked about. So this is not real data. This is a simulation from the model, okay? But I want to show you that the model suggests that the impacts from this are not small, and that's actually, if you look at what we've seen, when you look historically over the past 30 years and you just see how much marriage is sort of no longer the main number one way to have kids among certain groups, whereas it is still, you know, just incredibly common among other groups, right? It really suggests this divergent impact that the empirics showed of introducing this alternate contract for people who say, no, but because of my assets, the marriage contract is still a really great contract, versus for people who say, well, now the two contracts are the same because I don't have anything that makes them different. And so this is a simulation from the model where what we do is we take this income transfer that you're going to get when the relationship splits up, so child support basically, right? And we say, what happens if we experiment between making it zero if you're not married to, you know, kind of a large transfer, but not a complete transfer, right? If you were married, to then taking it up to this being, you know, like a quarter of the married transfer, to then taking it up to this being two-thirds of the married transfer. Sorry, one-third and then two-thirds. So that's what we experiment with. So no non-marital transfer means when you're married, you get a transfer, and if you weren't married, you just don't get any child support. The middle scenario is we make it one-third of the transfer you would get when married, and the last scenario is you make the non-marital transfer two-thirds of what you would have gotten. So child support is two-thirds as good on the non-marital contracting side versus the married contracting side. And then we show, what do people choose between being single, choosing non-marital fertility, which is the gray, versus being married. So if there is no non-marital transfer, then you're gonna see that people without assets are still gonna be sort of divided between whether they wanna get married versus not, because there's still things that make the marriage contract more appealing, but there's also, you know, reasons, because you have to pay a higher cost to get married, that you might want to stick with the non-marital contract. People with assets just basically 100% prefer the marriage contract, okay? When I introduce this medium level of the non-marital transfer, you're going to see that people without assets are going to really boost up their non-marital fertility, right? And marriage is going to drop, but it almost doesn't change the people with assets. And then this is the sort of scary one that shows you how big the implications are of this model, is that if I just make that non-marital transfer two-thirds, not all the way the what it is in the marital transfer, but two-thirds of what you get under marriage, people without assets entirely abandon marriage as their choice for how to have children, right? And whereas, again, people with assets are almost unaffected. So that just shows you that when we see this stunning transformation that people have called, you know, is it a culture change or is it a value change in how people choose to have children, that the legal changes and the concordant economic contracts that are available under those legal changes can actually be responsible for those changes and for that intense stratification. So let me just summarize, and then I want to get more into those policy implications. So we show that in a model where assets, in particular in the form of a marital home, can be anteed up to actually secure the contract, produces predictions that are consistent with both the broad empirical pattern that people with assets marry more, people who are more able to buy homes because of house price variation, marry more and invest more in children, but they're also consistent with these responses to policy changes and how that response has been stratified based on whether you have assets or not. So the mechanism is that assets provide commitment value that allows greater specialization within the home and more optimal investments in children, which makes marriage more valuable. So somewhat by design, we've chosen to make the model extremely stark, where that's all assets do, right? And as I mentioned, you can imagine owning a home has other benefits in terms of raising children and has like sort of direct effects. Why have we left that out? Because we wanted to show you that if I just have assets play this role, then you still get these tremendous effects without saying, oh, people with assets have lots of other benefits available to them, or they have different tastes, right? You could say that, but I'm showing you that without having that, just through the contracting role of assets, you get this big difference. And we've also experimented with including marriage timing, which also syncs up very well with historical trends and empirical patterns, which is that if we let people choose when to have children, when to get married, those without assets choose early non-marital fertility, whereas those with assets tend to choose later marriage, which syncs up with the pattern that we've seen, this divergence where on one hand, the average age of first motherhood is dropping, but on the other hand, people are getting married later and later. And so that actually comes out of our model as well. So are there any questions on that? And then I'm gonna get into the deeper policy implications. So the model is consistent with not just these patterns in the US, but I think it also would be interesting and certainly a fruitful avenue for future research to think about how does it sync up with global patterns in rates of marriage. So we know in Europe, marriage has also declined, right? And there's some differences there between the between how the cohabitation is treated versus marriage. So if you have cohabitation and marriage have a more similar contract when it comes to assets, you're gonna have less stratification there. So you're gonna have a more general decline in marriage rates. It's also true that housing prices are a lot higher and fewer people tend to be owners, right? Which is gonna, again, make this alternate avenue of securing your marriage contract less available. So you're gonna get a more general retreat from marriage, and you have a bigger substitute for insurance because you have a bigger social insurance market that might replace lost earnings if you ended up being divorced. It also syncs up with this idea that in urban areas, we see much lower rates of marriage than we see in rural areas, because again, housing prices are gonna be really high. You're gonna have less access to this ability to secure your marriage contract. But one that I definitely wanna highlight is that the racial gap in wealth in the United States is enormously larger than the income gap. The racial gap in wealth is just stunning. And the gap in home ownership is even larger because of practices like redlining and mortgage discrimination, right? And so when you look at our model, that tells you that, you know, this gap we see in marriage rates that some people have attributed to values or culture could actually be entirely coming from access to not just wealth, but to home ownership and the ability to actually get a mortgage. So the model provides an explanation for why marriages may lead to higher child investments and people from married families might sort of benefit without needing circular arguments about preferences. The people who have values that lead them to marriage also want to invest in their children, right? We don't need that argument because this actually provides a contracting reason why it's easier to invest in your children through marriage. And the policy implications of this is that wealth inequality, like we have in the US, is going to have extraordinarily deep implications. Because now it doesn't just impact, you know, what assets you have, it impacts what type of relationship you're able to enter into and how much you're able to invest in your children. Well, that means it's unlikely to self-correct, because if you start out with less wealth and then you can't get into this favorable contract to be able to invest in a lot in your children, then your children aren't going to have as many benefits later in life because they didn't benefit from that investment, right? So this problem isn't going to self-correct itself and just kind of solve itself with the next generation. We could end up with something like a poverty trap, where because you have wealth inequality in one generation, that creates a gap in the level of investment in the next generation, which just perpetuates that wealth gap. And it also implies that things like access to credit and home ownership, which are usually described as being about sort of housing justice, right, which is important in its own right, also are kind of going to directly affect people's relationship decisions and the level of investment they're able to make in their children. And so just to wrap up, you know, I think what this paper shows is that if you take marriage seriously as an economic contract, you're able to see why, when you change some policies that change that contracting environment, it might have deep economic and social implications and really lead to a transformed landscape like we see today, where marriage is no longer sort of the number one choice for how people have children. So I would love to take additional questions. Thank you very much. Yes.
Sorry, perhaps I missed this when you specified your model, but we're talking about TAL, the time investment that mothers make. Does that exclude any like financial investment, or like saying like some say like we want to talk like about like in the nanny effect, like you subcontract?
Definitely. So we assume that income directly impacts also your children's quality, and so when we write down the function of child quality, it's a function of income as well as this time investment, and that's why even in the absence of something like this mechanism, we see that higher income and higher wealth people also get more benefits from marriage, right? But what this mechanism sort of creates is sort of additional thing that's going on. So it's also true that just higher income people are able to invest this other thing, money, into their children. Yes?
Did you show us that among childless couples, assets don't predict home ownership? The story I have in mind is the causality goes the other way. It's actually that when I want to buy a home with someone, I get married because it's a huge financial transaction, and my dad, the lawyer, would never let me buy a house with someone I wasn't married to, right? Because it's just it's messy, and if something happens and you split up and you're not married, then that's a bad situation.
So it turns out that in the U.S., not only is homeownership very intimately tied to marriage, but having children is very tied to marriage, and that you see the rates of childlessness just decline like precipitously after marriage occurs. And so it's kind of hard to identify the people who get married and plan to stay childless for the long term. And in fact, if you take the model literally, which you shouldn't, right? People always get married for love and for other reasons, right? But if you take the model seriously, you know, marriage is about harvesting these gains to child investment. So why would you get married and except to sort of ensure this contract about having children? Like, there's maybe not as much you need to contract on if you're planning not to have children, which is why perhaps we don't see as much and very many childless marriages. I will say that you don't see. We've also looked at whether people who have children outside of marriage also sort of get homes, because maybe it's that, hey, you got married and then you had a child and you want to buy a home for the children to live in, and we don't see that. So homeownership rates stay flat after you have a child. They only go up after you get married, and we were saying it's sort of in anticipation of having a child, even if you don't have one at the moment. Yes, here's the member.
We have two more minutes. So I'm thinking now about single parents. So, and I'm thinking of a paper by Kathy Eden, a sociologist, who talked about this being a constrained choice for poor, particularly poor mothers, deciding to have a child but not a partner, even cohabitation.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, I know that work well.
And right. So, how should I think about that? Because what she also said, in your words, is that having a child was more of a private good than a public good for her. It's also an alternative for an investment in old age. So it's a bit of a security. That she's investing in, maybe because she doesn't have the house, or maybe she doesn't have a partner, or they're not available. Or how should I think about the single?
Yes. So that's a great question, and I think that it also speaks to where can we take this research next. People have suggested, well, what about, how is this going to differ in developing countries where children are thought of as an investment rather than being something that you invest in, right? Although you still have to invest in them in the beginning, as our family homework shows. So I think you might have a child, but you're choosing a different type of motherhood and a different type of relationship, right? Because you're exactly that. You're saying, I am having this child because I want to sort of have a child, and I want to maybe have this old age security. But because she is single, she's not going to be able to afford to, you know, stay home and do baby Einstein all day, right, with that child, right? So it's something, you know, as we see that as people get wealthier, they substitute from child quantity to child quality, right? You're kind of choosing this different way of becoming a mother, and it's definitely a way that is going to have implications for the next generation. So I think that is, it's not fully in our model, but I think you're right that it's something that we should discuss and kind of wrestle with a little bit more. Yes, Kathleen.
So, Susan Bianchi has this really provocative work that shows that when you
say the last name again,
Bianchi, B-I-A-N-C-H-I, that shows. So she follows from 1970, I think she starts, and she goes into she just passed away last year, but goes into I think 2015, and shows that actually there aren't fewer hours invested in children as women are employed. So there's a big substitution going on, whereas we get sort of shortcuts for cooking and homemaking and things like that. We invest all that time in our kids.
Oh, so yes, absolutely. So on the high end, in terms of when you look at very high human capital women, high human capital women do not spend less time with their children, but I would argue that that is extremely costly to them, right? And that it means on the margin, they're not making those human capital investments in themselves, right? So with, and
but she shows that it's not correlated with employment.
I'm not saying that they're not employed, but I'm saying if the difference is, are you on the partner track at the iBank or at the law firm, right? And if it's who has to work between 8 and 11, the husband, and the American Timing Survey shows this, is the one working between 8 and 11, right? And 11 p.m., and she's not. And so that's sort of exactly the sort of interesting puzzle, is that even as women have worked and you can afford these other things, we still see this enormous investment in child human capital because it's extremely valuable.
Yeah. Okay, well, Corinne, thank you so much.
I'll see if you have other questions.
Thank you. This was fantastic. And I also had to, as you know, as an economist, I had to juggle a little bit. And you're really an economist. And how you're talking about everything. So I love to be reminded of marginal benefits and cost there. No, it's fantastic. So we'll have Thanksgiving next week. So happy Thanksgiving. And then we'll be back here with Kelly Bedard. She's joining us from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And she's going to talk about equal but inequitable. Who benefits from gender-neutral tenure clock stuff policies? Nobody. Unimportant topic.
And it relates to what I talked about today.
Yeah.
Okay.